Meet almost Dr. Mary Tate, who has an MPH from Harvard and is a fourth-year medical student at Harvard Medical School. While pursuing her MD and MPH, or just before then, she also co-founded two not-for-profits and recently started her own pre-med podcast. Let's hear her story. Welcome to the 257th episode of Admission Straight Talk, Accepted's podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in." Not only in, but in at the best program for you. Our guest today, soon-to-be Dr. Mary Tate and current fourth-year medical student at Harvard Medical School, graduated from Dartmouth in 2012 and has been at Harvard Medical since 2013. She was very active at Dartmouth and continued following her graduation, as we'll soon learn. In 2017, she earned her MPH at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health, and by the end of the month, she will be Dr. Mary Tate. Mary, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, you know, where you grew up, stuff like that?
Certainly. So I grew up in Kenosha, Wisconsin. It's actually the most southeastern city in the state. My family is originally from Chicago, but my mom moved to Wisconsin a little before I was born. So I'm the youngest of eight children. So I come from a very, very big family. I have 18 nieces and nephews. So there were always lots of folks around. Yeah. So it was always really fun growing up. There was always someone around, always someone to learn from, always something to do and to contribute to our household. I guess some of the things that I really loved about where I grew up and the house that I grew up in Kenosha, I went to the public schools in our hometown, but our public schools really valued the arts. And so since I was really young, I was involved in the arts. From fourth grade, I was playing the violin. We couldn't afford a violin, but I was able to, my mom said to me, well, write an essay about all the reasons why you want to play, and maybe we can get your essay to someone, and maybe someone can help us pay for you to have a violin. And so I did that. I got a violin, and I started playing when I was in fourth grade. By the time I got to middle school, I started doing theater. So the middle school I went to put on three productions every year, and so I started doing theater as a middle school student. And then when I got to high school, our high school did about 10 to 12 shows a year. So I have never been a stranger to the stage and have been singing and dancing and acting and playing the violin since I was pretty young. And so that was a really big part of my upbringing. And in a funny way, I came back around to all of those things in medical school, which I never thought that I would. But that was a really special part of my growing up. And then my family was a huge part of my experience growing up. I have a brother who has a severe intellectual disability. He's 8 years older than me. And so another big part of my growing up was being a caregiver and learning how to care for other people. When he was growing up, he couldn't feed himself or, you know, bathe himself or clothe himself. So those are all things that I was learning how to do, is to be there for someone else who needed it. And so I think those were all really important things in how I grew up.
Wow, those sounds like pretty impressive experiences. Do you still sing and act and do all that stuff? Sounds like you do.
I do, which is so shocking. I didn't think that that was something that would continue forward throughout my kind of path to medicine. So I actually dance with a dance group in Cambridge. I take classes every Monday at the dance complex. Wow. And I dance with this group. I do hip-hop dancing, and we perform different places. Performed in different showcases at different schools, performed for a wedding once before.
Wow.
all things that are still happening in medical school, which I didn't expect. Also in medical school, there tends to be a lot of different kind of art showcases. So we actually, this weekend coming up, have our big revisit weekend where all of the students who were admitted to Harvard in this cycle, they come to visit our school and see if it's the right fit for them. And the mainstay of that weekend is a show that's called Fabric, where it's a multicultural show, really showing the diversity of people who are at our institution. It was started about 18 years ago by an African-American woman, a student here, and it wasn't originally part of the revisit weekend, but it became something that was so popular that it became part of the whole Revisit Weekend is now the center of that. So I performed in that. We do a music video every year during our recruitment during that Revisit Weekend. We also, when I was a second year, there was a tradition of the second year show. And so I got to play one of the leads in that show and sing and dance and do some acting there as well. So yeah, surprisingly, I've been still doing a lot of singing and dancing and acting all throughout medical school, which was a pleasant surprise.
What about violin? Still do that?
No, the last time I played my violin was my high school graduation. I played in the orchestra for my graduation, and that was the last time, sadly, that I played.
Probably the last time I played my flute, too. But anyways, my high school graduation. And I think I did it once in college. Anyways.
Yeah.
Let's think back a little bit to your applying to medical school, and obviously now you're yeah. giving advice to pre-meds. What did you find most difficult?
The personal statement. That was easily the most difficult part of the process for a number of reasons, I think. First, that it's something that should really take place over the course of months, really trying to get to the right thing that meets the word limit, tells all about who you are, talks about why you want to be a physician, and has some kind of cohesive theme to it. Like, to accomplish all of that and still feel like it feels unique and not, you know, cheesy in some kind of way is really challenging. And it requires a lot of reflection, a lot of introspection. I remember when I was first starting out writing it, I just kind of broke down. I was talking to my best friend who read all of the iterations of my personal statement. And I got into this point where I thought, this sounds like what probably everyone else is saying. You know, I want to be a doctor because I want to help alleviate suffering. But like, everyone's saying that. And so I kept like, really, every time I write something, I say, no, this is awful. I can't use this. But over time, what I learned was that just the more that I continued to write, the more I was able to start to anchor that into my life experiences and make it sound more my own. I actually just talked about personal statement writing on my last episode of my podcast because it was such a challenging part of the process for me. And I think that what I have to come around to and realize is that, yes, I want to be a doctor because I want to alleviate suffering. And that can sound a little cliche, but I hope that all people going into medicine, that that's something that they care about. So what makes it unique is for me to tie in all the life experiences that have led me to this decision of why I want to alleviate suffering through medicine.
Exactly.
What has led me to this kind of decision now, and why does this make sense for my life, given what I've experienced over time? And so it's such a long process to do that. And I think often students, they think it'll go a little bit quicker than the process actually does. Yeah. And so that was probably the most challenging part of the process. And then I always felt like, I don't want to be a burden to other people and asking them to read my personal statement. And you need to have a number of different eyes in your personal statement. I actually also recommend that you have one person that sees all the different drafts. So, you know, that's usually a best friend who loves you enough where they will read it time and time again. But it's so hard. It was the hardest part of the process for me.
Yes, it is hard. I mean, one of the things that we frequently advise applicants on their personal statements, and I frequently hear from applicants, I want to go into medicine because I want to help people. And my standard answer to that is, you know, if my toilet is stopped up and I call a plumber, he's helping me. Why do you want to help people in this particular way? And that goes back to what, you know, your comment. That usually gives them some pause to that question. But why, you know, that goes back to your personal experiences, your life to date. Now, you, in responding to my first question, you said, you know, you had this kind of formative experience with your older brother in terms that you needed to serve and to help care for him. And I'm sure there were other formative experiences, and we might even discuss some of them. But that clearly was a very influential experience. And then you can say, well, obviously, there's different forms of caring and or alleviating suffering, as you said. And then why this form? And that will, of course, relate to your life experiences. And those are unique.
Right.
What would you have changed about your approach to the medical school application process if you had to do it all over again? Other than not starting to cry when you start down to write your personal statement and got frustrated.
You know, I can't say that there is anything I would have changed about how I went through the process. I think that some of the things that helped me, I think, in the process was starting really early. Mm-hmm. And by the time I got to the point of applying, I had learned that it was okay to ask for help. So that was something that I had to learn all throughout college in terms of asking professors to look over my personal statement and to give me their comments and give me their feedback, and to reach out to my pre-med advisor as I was going through the process at each stage and really get some feedback. And so while it was a very challenging process and experience, I think that I reached the point when I had applied that I knew how to utilize the resources that were available to me. And so I can't really say that there is something in particular that I would have done differently. Mm-hmm. But I think that all of that kind of work I had been doing in college, getting comfortable, asking for help, you know, being resourceful and figuring out what's at my disposal. I think if I hadn't done that work in the years prior to applying, those would be the things that I would be thinking about and would be telling someone to really think about as they're going through this process. You know, so many people try to go in at this alone, and that isn't necessarily the best way to do it. There's a lot of people around you potentially who can help you out as you're going through this process. And so if you have that, you should definitely use it. So I don't think that there is anything I would change in particular, but I would make sure that I kind of did those things again, is to ask for help and to utilize the resources that are available to me.
Sounds good. And I do think that asking for help is important. I don't recommend like asking all your Facebook friends what they think of your personal statement, but but I do think going to, you know, a couple under five trusted people who either know you really well or know the process really well or know how to write well really well is just a very valuable way to approach the writing process.
When I look back on the people that I had involved, particularly in the personal statement, I go into this in detail my podcast, but I think the key people that I needed, and I think most students need in this process, is one, having that person that I've mentioned before, like that best friend who's willing to look at all the iterations and see it grow and who knows you very well and can say when they read it, I don't get you when I read this. I don't see your personality shine through. Mm-hmm. Someone who can see it as it's progressing. I think it's important to have, you know, someone, for me, that was my sister, someone who is a grammar whiz and is very neurotic about all of those little like mistakes that you might have, who can look through, who's not looking for content, but really just looking to make sure that the structure is appropriate, that you're not making silly grammatical mistakes or silly spelling errors. With that, you need to have a person like that. And then I also made sure I had, you know, two folks who were professors or, you know, people in academia, one to look at my personal statement when I felt I had the first draft of the personal statement that I felt proud of. And so that's not going to happen right away. Like that took some time to get to that place. Mm-hmm. But have the first draft that I was willing for someone outside of my close friend to really see this first draft, for them to give me some constructive criticism and feedback, and then work on it some more. And then have someone also, a different professor, to look at the personal statement or pre-med advisor when I think it's done, when I've met the word limit, when I don't have any errors, and I think I'm ready to press submit, have one more person to look at it who's never seen it before, who can with fresh eyes just say, wow, well done, you're ready to submit. Because it's nice to have someone who's never seen it look at it the first time and have no comments. And so I thought that having that combination of people, for me, I had four people. Those combination of people really helped me get from beginning to end.
Thank you. Now, you are finishing up your studies at Harvard Medical. Your graduation the show is going to air May 1st, and I assume your graduation is just a couple of weeks after that, right?
That's correct. We graduate on May 24th.
Okay, it's coming up. And you already have your MPH. What did you like best about your medical school experience, and what are you going to miss, if anything?
I think the thing that I like the best is also the thing that I'm going to miss the most. It's the people. There were a number of reasons why I chose to come to Harvard Medical School. The chiefest among them was the people, from my classmates to my professors to the staff that work here. The amount of care and support and time and energy people pour into you, developing as a person, as a future physician, and really supporting your goals and your dreams and the ways in which you want to help patients is really incredible. I've reached out to so many faculty here, so many attendings here about an idea I had or something that seemed a little off the beaten path and was never met with well, I don't think you can do that, or that's something that people don't necessarily do. So do you want to go down that path? I was never met with that kind of reaction. I was always met with, how can I help? Or what resources can I direct you to get you to the place that you want to go? So I'm going to miss the people so much. I mean, my classmates are all incredible and they inspire me, and to see them do the things that they love in so many different fields, things that I like don't have necessarily an interest or a passion in, but to see their passion for the work that they do is so incredibly inspiring. And just to have easy access to them all the time to talk about what they're fired up about and the work that they're doing, I'm going to miss that so much. I have really built a family here. And so it's going to be incredibly hard to say goodbye to that family. From my mentors to my classmates, I just feel very, very fortunate to have had this community in which to grow and thrive. So I'm going to miss that.
What do you think could be improved?
You know, I think with any institution of this size, change can be a little slow. And so, I mean, that's something that we're always thinking about and always working on. I've had the privilege of sitting on a number of different committees here at the medical school. Again, one of the things I really enjoy is that students get to have lots of input about what's happening here at the school. And I think something that students tend to find challenging is on some of the bigger things, it can feel like it's a little bit slow. And so that's challenging. But then I also kind of being able to sit in those roles and on those committees, I recognize the deliberate nature that an institution like this has to have in order to really be thoughtful about the changes they make. So, for instance, I sit on the task force on diversity and inclusion here at the medical school. And I've been working with this task force for a number of months now. And we just reached the end of the first phase of our work with the task force, which was putting out our diversity statement for the medical school. And while, you know, a student who may not be sitting on that committee might think, wow, I mean, they've been in meetings months and months and months. I'm like, what's taking so long? So much of that ends up being making sure we hear the voices of all members of our community and being very thoughtful about every single word that goes into that statement that we put out. And so I think one of the things that's challenging or like hard for people to kind of grapple with is how slow it takes for an institution of this size to change and to move. But it's also been really a privilege to be able to be a part of that process. So yeah, I guess I hope that kind of answers your question. It can be frustrating to see that change can sometimes be a little slow, but I understand also on this side why that happens. But yeah.
What were some of the changes that you were trying to work towards?
Oh, I mean, a number of things. So one of my friends, as a different committee that I wasn't on, was a part of the committees that have worked to change the curriculum at the medical school here. And so now we have a new curriculum. We have had already our second class of students go through, you know, start in the new curriculum. And that was something that took lots and lots of time for that to happen.
Sure.
You know, like the diversity statement was something I was involved in. That took a long time for us to get to that place. And ultimately, one of the goals of our task force is really to put out recommendations for the dean and for the school to think about how we think about diversity and inclusion in all aspects of the community here at Harvard. So that includes the hospitals, that includes, you know, the classroom and the medical students, that includes the labs that are around the quad, and any people who has a kind of a touch point with Harvard Medical School, the communities that we work with and that we are a part of. So it's the work of the task force is quite large, and the recommendations that we're hoping to make, we want them to be recommendations that help us think about how we move forward and how we track our progress in moving forward. And so those are things that take a while really to make sure that we're not missing really big parts of our community and that we really have the input of everyone. And so that's one of the things to answer your questions that we're working on is thinking about what recommendations we should be giving the dean to really help us continue to move forward in the work of diversity and inclusion here at Harvard Medical School. So it's been really a pleasure and a privilege to be a part of that work.
Okay. How did you or why did you decide to get the MPH in addition to the MD? And why did you choose to focus on quantitative methods?
Yeah. So when I think about the career that I want to have in obstetrics and gynecology, one of the major things that draws me to the field is I am very interested in work reducing racial and ethnic inequities in birth outcomes mm-hmm. in the United States. In particular, you know, things like maternal mortality or morbidity. Black women, as has been in the media a lot lately, are 3 to 4 times more likely to die than white women in the U.S. when it comes to pregnancy-related things. Similarly, their children are much more likely to die before they reach their first birthday than white children in this country. And that is an issue that I'm very passionate about and really want to work toward closing that gap. And I felt like getting this additional degree would help me have the tools toward working on these issues. So what I found currently when it comes to the media, as well as a lot of medical literature, we tend to see a lot of literature that talks about characterizing the problem, so the epidemiology of what is happening as it relates to birth outcomes in the United States, right? Like, I can rattle off these numbers that Black women are dying 3 to 4 times more likely than the U.S., but it's not as easy to rattle off what are the interventions that people are doing that's actually working to help move the needle in a positive direction. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the Chan School to get a master's in public health and quantitative methods because I wanted to have the skills to think about how do I offer skills to places and communities that are already doing really incredible work, but then don't have the tools to figure out if the programs and the things that they're doing is actually being effective in the communities where they're working. And so I wanted to really have the skills of program evaluation and research design to really think about how we look at what's already happening, the work that's already being done, and if we're making a dent in these communities where this work is happening. And so that's why I decided to go to the Chan School for my master's in public health. And that's why I decided to focus on quantitative methods. That field of study is jointly housed in the biostatistics and the epidemiology department, and really helped me think from a researcher's perspective about how you would go about doing something like this. And so for my practicum, or, you know, basically my thesis and my master's program, I was able to work with the CDC and the Nevada's Department of Health and Human Services, working on designing a program evaluation for one of their Title V programs. So the federal state block grants that give money to states for doing work with maternal and child health. So we were particularly focused on preconception, interconception care in the state of Nevada. And so mm-hmm. that was a chance for me to use the skills that I was learning in my master's to do the kind of work that I want to do, thinking about program evaluation. So that's why I went there. And that's kind of how I hope to use those skills going forward.
Do you see yourself being a practicing OBGYN as well as devising these kinds of programs? Do you see yourself doing both? How do you see you?
Yeah. So I guess I would start by first saying that I am very aware that these things have a way of changing and evolving over time mm-hmm. throughout your training. But currently, today, my plan is to become a generalist. So I always want to practice. I always want to be delivering babies and taking care of women, doing gynecology and surgery. Those are all things that I really want to always be a part of my career, is to be a practitioner of medicine. In addition, I want to be a public health advocate, and I see many avenues through which I can do that. One of those pieces is using the skills I've learned at the Chan School to do this kind of program evaluation work that I was talking about. And the other avenue that I'm really interested in is the intersection of medicine and media. So there's lots of literature, and, you know, people anecdotally know this, that a lot of individuals get their information about health from television and from media. And so that offers a really great opportunity for us to, as practitioners, as physicians, to give health and wellness messages to the lay public who doesn't have a medical background, and also to take medical literature and to digest it for people and to put it in a form that people can begin to understand, does this research study that is making all these headlines, does it apply to me and how? And so that's another thing that my master's has given me the skills to do, is to really think about how does one consume medical literature and how do you break it down and explain it into its essential elements, and who is this study applicable to, and what are the implications of this study? Was it a well-done study? How generalizable is it? So these are all skills that I was able to acquire during my master's, and I hope to lend those skills to the program evaluation piece, but also to really educating the public about health and about wellness and about these, you know, different articles and studies that end up in these headlines, and to really help people understand and to digest them. So that's what I see right now for my career, and we'll see how it takes shape over time.
Yeah, I hope we will. I definitely look forward to hearing about it. Now, you were active as an undergrad at Dartmouth, and you obviously have the public health interest going forward. And after Dartmouth, you started two not-for-profits. I think you told me one was like in the gap year and one was right after you got to Harvard. You started medical students offering maternal support, moms, and pathways to medicine. Can you tell me about them or tell us about them, and why did you start them?
So I'll start kind of in chronological order. So after I graduated from Dartmouth, I worked with a team of folks to start a program called Pathways to Medicine. So that team included myself, one of the pre-med advisors at Dartmouth, my major advisor actually from college, a professor in biology, a couple of current students at the time, and someone who worked for our academic skills center. And I came to this team with an idea that I felt like as a student going through Dartmouth, it seemed like there could be a little bit more guidance in terms of how students can access resources who are interested in medicine. And particularly, how can we utilize our alumni base to really engage, mentor, and support students who are interested in medicine, and particularly students who are traditionally underrepresented in medicine. So that was why we started this program called Pathways to Medicine. So it's a program that's open to any student at Dartmouth, but we really try to target students who are traditionally underrepresented in medicine and really kind of give them some wraparound support and guidance on this path. One of the key elements to what we do in the Pathways to Medicine program is we have a retreat every summer. We go to this really beautiful place nearby our school in Vermont, and we have a day where the students can get away from the campus, which can be a little crazy and hectic at times, and we bring alumni to Vermont who are at all different stages of their career. So we bring medical students who are alumni, residents, attending physicians who work in administration in medical schools, like, you know, people who are on admissions committees, and we have a full day of programming to really support these students. So on a number of topics, whether it be about the application or about like burnout or how students are, you know, navigating the sciences at Dartmouth. And so we spend this whole day really trying to support students and mostly really trying to build these connections between alumni and students, such that when this day is over, they will now have seen a face and hopefully feel comfortable reaching out to our alumni to ask them questions and to be mentored by them. So at the end of this retreat every summer, I have a new set of mentees from Dartmouth who then feel comfortable because they've now seen my face to reach out to me, and we'll talk and I'll advise through video chats and things like that. In addition to that, every term we bring, you know, an alum back to campus to talk about a number of different topics, whether it's about what life is like after you're a physician, or helping them thinking about different study strategies, or preparing for the MCAT. So a number of different things, but really the purpose of the Pathways to Medicine program is really to support these students to reach their goals, whatever they may be. And the MOM program, Medical Students Offering Maternal Support, is a program that I co-founded with one of my classmates, Jody Rimmelin, when we were first-year medical students. It was born out of the idea that kind of I was exposed to in the work that I did right after Dartmouth. So I was a public service fellow from Dartmouth, the Richard D. Lombard Public Service Fellow, and it allowed me to work for a nonprofit for 1 year after college at no cost to them. And so at this nonprofit, One Heart Worldwide, I got to learn a lot about this community health worker model, which is used a lot in the international setting. And so I've been reading and thinking about how people try to take this model and bring it to an American context. And one of the things that I thought about was we have medical students who are this eager, excited, renewable resource that's very cheap, who are really interested in working with patients. And so basically what this program does is we match medical students one-to-one with a woman who is pregnant at one of the community health centers affiliated with Harvard, a woman who could use additional supports in pregnancy. So our patients have included folks who are differently abled, folks who are recent immigrants, people who are experiencing homelessness, people who just maybe not have a lot of people showing up with them to their appointments, or people who will be at labor and delivery by themselves, or people who are very young and pregnant, people who could use some additional support as they're going through this process. That is really crazy.
What kind of support do the pre-med students, or the med students rather, provide?
Med students, yeah.
Yeah.
a number of things, from things like helping them sign up for different social services and be aware of what's available to them depending on where they live in the greater Boston area, to, you know, for these patients who are being seen at a community health center, there are some times when they have some kind of complication or some issue that requires them to come for some special evaluation at the hospital before they even deliver. And so having someone who's familiar and knows them accompany them to the hospital in a place that is very different to them, that they don't know anyone there, and kind of going through this really scary process. The students come to the labor and delivery, and they're there to be a support to them. And the students go through training to do this, but, you know, they learn how to support a woman during labor and delivery. That's a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it ends up being helping to be a mediator between the patient and the care team. Sometimes things get a little lost in the process and there can be misunderstandings. And as a student, someone who's kind of straddling both the medical space, not yet being a doctor, and, you know, not totally being a part of the lay public, you can really be in this space where you can really help navigate and help the patient advocate for themselves. So that's kind of the space that they operate in. Someone who's trying to really help the patient speak up and get the answers to the questions that they want and navigate the healthcare system, which they may not have been exposed to. A lot of times our patients who are being seen during pregnancy have not been seeing a provider regularly prior to getting pregnant. They're seeing providers because now they're pregnant. And so the whole healthcare system can be a little jarring and there's a lot going on. And so the students are really there to help them navigate that.
Do they ever act as Lamaze coaches or not too much?
The students do get training by one of our sessions for the students is led by a doula and a midwife so that they can learn and know the different positions that are helpful in the different stages of labor. But, you know, the labor nurses and all the folks who are there on labor and delivery still kind of are there doing their job. The student is just there to kind of be an additional person to help and support. That's not necessarily there because that's their job to be there, but they're there to just support them for whatever they need. Yeah.
Got it. Now, you mentioned your podcast earlier. Your podcast is Dear Pre-Med. What is its focus?
Yeah.
And why add producing a podcast to your very crowded schedule? Are you doing it monthly or bi-week?
I'm doing it monthly.
Monthly. Okay. So,
yeah. So
what and why?
Yeah. So I'll start with the why.
Okay.
I have been very passionate about doing work to diversify the faith of medicine. And I have done a lot of work locally in the Boston area, also back at Dartmouth with my Pathways to Medicine program, really thinking about getting students the support they need to achieve the goals that they have for themselves. And I've realized that there are a couple of things that seem to be helpful to students that are pretty predictable. And I wanted to find a way to continue to do that work of reaching out to students and supporting the students who need that support, but in a way that I could manage as a resident. So some of the things that I'm doing right now, I'm not going to be able to do as a resident. There's just not enough time. I have to be doing the work of learning to be an obstetrician gynecologist. So, you know, now that I'm moving to Chicago for residency, I won't be able to go back to the Pathways to Medicine program at Dartmouth like I am accustomed to. So right now I usually go there every other term and I'm talking with students. That's not going to be feasible for me anymore. Or I sit with students at Harvard College or at the MCPHS, another local college right near Harvard Med, and a bunch of different colleges here, and talk face-to-face with students and able to answer their questions. And those kinds of things won't be as easy for me to do as a resident. And so I want to think about how do I take these things that I know are helpful to students and reach more people. And so I have been into podcasting, and one of the things that some mentors here have helped me and been supporting me in, I wanted to kind of navigate this space of medicine and media. And so I spent a good part of my fourth year medical school really navigating the space and learning as much as I could. So I have a membership at a local media center, and I've taken classes on podcasting and film and all different things in production, you name it. I've probably taken a class in it. And so I love podcasts, and I felt like this is a really great forum and a way to reach students that people are doing. People are listening to podcasts. So that's why I came to starting Dear Pre-Med. And what it is, it's a monthly podcast that usually is about 30 to 45 minutes. The main component, there are three segments of the podcast. The main segment of the podcast is I interview a physician or a physician in training about their journey to medicine. But what I really try to focus on is some of the challenges or bumps in the road that they faced, and how they still got to where they wanted to be. Because I think as pre-meds, we often go to these talks and hear these really incredible people, and we see their CVs or we hear their introductions, and all we hear are the perfect positive things when they made it to where they wanted to go, but we never hear about the failures along the way. And so I really hope to, with these interviews and this podcast, show those things and also just show people coming from all different backgrounds and making it to their kind of end destination. And so I really try to feature guests who are underrepresented in medicine in one way or another, whether that's because of their race or ethnicity, or because one of my most recent guests on the show, she's a woman who was diagnosed with a learning disability our first year in medical school. And so I really try to uplift the narratives of people who you don't typically hear who are in medicine. And so that's one of the main things that I try to do, because I find that it's something that can be very uplifting for students to see someone hear someone that they identify with in one way or another. The other two segments of the show, I have a segment where I give advice about a topic that people email in about. And so I get questions about all different things. And each month I try to answer one of those questions. So most recently I talked about personal statements in the podcast, or I previously talked about mentorship versus sponsorship and what are the differences, and kind of how do you navigate relationships that you want to build with mentors and sponsors. So each month I have a different topic that people can email in about, and I'll answer their questions. And the final segment of the show, I do a medical minute on health in the news. And so that has ranged from all different things, from kind of what's happening in Puerto Rico to most recently I talked about this really interesting study that just came out in the New England Journal of Medicine about Black barbershops and reducing blood pressure. It was done in LA County.
Really?
Really interesting study. So I talk about, a range of things, and it's a medical minute. I try to keep it around a minute or 2 minutes. And so the podcast ends up being 30 to 45 minutes, and I do it monthly, and it's something that I really enjoy. And I've been getting emails from students who've been listening to the podcast, and it really fills my soul. I'm just like so excited to be able to do this and to put this work out there, put this podcast out there for students who could use the uplifting, like they're like stuck in their books and doing all of the hard work that they need to do to get where they want to go. Something to kind of uplift them and help them along the way.
We're going to link to the podcast from the show notes, which will be at exhibit.com/257, so that listeners can check it out. I listened to a couple of episodes. I thought it was good. And certainly the goals are right for it to be very valuable for pre-meds. What you've alluded to your post-Harvard plans, but can you tell us a little bit? What are your plans for residency and beyond?
Certainly. So I am so excited. I'm headed to Northwestern for a residency in obstetrics and gynecology. And so as a resident there, I will have the privilege of taking care of patients both at the main University Northwestern Hospital in downtown Chicago and at the Stroger Cook County Hospital, which is the safety net hospital for the city of Chicago. And so I am so thrilled. It'll be a 4-year residency program. Currently, I don't plan to do fellowship. So at the end of that time, I'll start working as an attending somewhere. I ultimately hope to be taking care of Black and brown patients. Like, those are the people that brought me to medicine. And so I really want to give back to communities that look like me, and think a lot about what I was mentioning before in terms of these inequities and birth outcomes we're seeing in the U.S. by race and ethnicity. And so I really want a lot of my career to be centered around that. So I'm really excited to be learning from all the incredible physicians and nurses and patients that are out there in Chicago. And it's coming home for me. I'm the only one of my siblings who is not born or raised in Chicago. So now I'll finally get that chance to be there in Chicago and spend some time there, and looking forward to being in some of the hospitals where my family received care. You know, these are places that my mom went when she lived out in Chicago. I still have aunts and uncles, and my grandmother lives out in Chicago, and cousins. And so it'll be a really lovely coming home and taking care of my community. So I'm so thrilled. I'm so thrilled to be headed there.
That's great. Now, is your family still living in Wisconsin now, or does it has it moved back to Chicago?
No, so my immediate family still lives in Kenosha, and it's really fantastic. There is a train that goes from downtown Chicago, and the North Line, the last stop, is my hometown.
Oh, wonderful.
So I will be just an hour and 20-minute express train away from home. So
and I'm no really airplane. Excited. No airplane needed.
No airplane. I'm so excited.
Yeah, that is exciting. And I know if I don't have to get on an airplane or go to an airport, I'm a very happy person. What would you actually, I do want to ask you something before I ask you my last question. And this goes back to, this is a question I've started asking more and more either med students or medical school residents. And it goes along with the idea of just letting people know that it's not all smooth sailing. It's not all, you know, kind of up and to the right spread chart, you know, kind of graph kind of thing. That's not life, and it isn't medical school either.
Yeah.
And I don't do this to be negative. I do this because I want people to have a realistic idea of what they're getting into. Was there ever a time in medical school or so far where you said, you know, I really don't think this is for me?
I can't say that there was.
Okay,
I will say, though, that there are lots of times when it's very hard. I can't say that there's ever a time when I thought it wasn't for me. There was a time. So I wanted to be an OBGYN since I was a little kid. Like, I have an All About Me book that I made in elementary school where you kind of say what you want to do when you grow up. And I remember raising my hand and asking the teacher, how do you spell obstetrician? Because that's what I wanted to do. My mom had told me that obstetricians bring babies in the world. And I was like, sign me up. I want to do that. Mm-hmm. There was a time in medical school where I thought, wait, do I want to be an OBGYN? And I think that was because I had felt like I had kind of stacked the deck in a way where so many of the experiences that I had, I pushed myself in that direction, and I was exposed to these things because I'd always had this dream of being an OBGYN. And so there was a moment where I had to say, wait, do I want to do this because I've been working toward it, and so everything I've been exposed to has been related to OBGYN? I remember that moment when I was as a third year medical student and doing my rotation. And when I got to my OBGYN rotation, I was like, oh, right. Yeah, this is why I love it. So I had that moment during medical school, but I've never doubted my desire to be a physician and to do this work. I mean, there's been so many patients, the things that really lift me up and remind me why I'm doing the work that I'm doing and why I have to push through when it's really challenging is when I see patients, particularly Black patients, who tell me, I'm the first Black physician to ever take care of them. And I'm not even a doctor yet. I'm a medical student. Mm-hmm. And that happens far too often. And so it's moments like that when I'm able to kind of put a smile on someone's face just by walking into the room, or able to connect with a patient in some different way, or to gather a little bit more information from the patient because maybe they identify with me a little bit more, that reminds me why I need to be doing the work that I want to do. And so I can't honestly say that I've ever doubted that medicine was right for me, but it is hard. It is challenging. Yeah.
All right. What would you have liked me to ask you?
One of the things that I would have liked you to ask is how the art has helped me in medicine.
Okay.
I think that so often I talk to students and it seems like the thing that you're supposed to do is major in a science and, you know, not pursue some of these other maybe off the beaten path type things. But I think the arts and theater in particular have helped me so much in medicine. And I'll give you one of the, there's many things that's helped me with, but one of the many things that I've learned from theater that I bring into medicine is when I was studying theater and doing this work and doing improv classes, rule one of improv is yes and, which means that if you're doing an improv scene and you're in a scene with your scene partner, if they throw something out there and call you like, the celebrity, or you're in an airplane, or whatever the scenario they set, you can't say no to that. You just go with it. You meet them where they are, and you continue the scene. That's the rule number one of improv. And so I've taken that with me to every clinical encounter that I've had. You meet the patient where they are. You say yes and. Patients come with so many different life experiences that bring them to where they are in that space. And it's so important to walk into the room and to say yes and. And to just meet them where there's some things that we might want to prescribe to a patient or we want them to do that just do not fit with the life that they have, or they don't have the resources to do things exactly the way that you might want to have them do it. And so you have to meet them where they are and figure out how can you do the best that you can and get them what they need in order to take the best care of them. And so that yes and principle of improv and in theater is something that has helped me tremendously in medicine and that I carry with me. And there's been many other lessons, but that'll be the one that I'll share. I think that the arts can really help us in medicine.
That's a fantastic way to end the interview. You've been really generous with your time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me, for sharing your insights and your experience and your thoughts. Where can listeners find you and your podcast, Dear Premed?
Perfect. So the podcast is on the podcast app. It's Dear Premed. You can just search that in the podcast app. You could also look at my website, which is www.dearpremed.com. And you can find me on Instagram and Twitter under the handle Mary Tate MD. And you can find all the information you need from any of those places.
Sounds good. We'll link to Dear Premed as well as other resources related to this podcast from accepted.com/257. I also want to give you a quick heads up as to what's coming. I have some really exciting podcasts coming up and great guests. Next week, we're going to host Dr. Nadia Afridi, who is a plastic surgeon and just completed her EMBA from Columbia. She's also a mom, obviously a very busy person, but she's going to take time out of her schedule to visit with us. And following that will be a Sloan Fellows MBA student, also a mom. Right around Mother's Day, we'll be having both of those, Katie Luby. So stay tuned. Even if you're not a mother, I'm sure you're going to benefit from these women's perspective on their education and their work experience. Listener, thank you too for joining Mary Tate and me for Mission Straight Talk's 257th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, I have a favor to ask. Please tell your friends about the podcast. Your doing so helps us spread the news about Admission Straight Talk. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.